Shalom leYudim, shalom lebnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. It's the evening of the second day, Kaf Tes B'Iyar, Tav Shin Ayin Hey, Parashas Bamidbar, the evening of the first day, Sunday, 17 May 2015. Webcasting from the land of Israel on this day, 48 years ago, that Jerusalem returned to Jewish sovereignty for the first time since the days of the Caesars, since before the advent of Christianity. What a stunning moment that was, what a week that was. Nothing in my lifetime equals that for its roller coaster of fear and exaltation. In mid-May 1967, the reigning pharaoh in that nation of Hamitic slaves, Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, ordered the United Nations Separation of Forces units in the Gaza Strip and Sinai to pack up and go home. Though a common account by respected historians is that Nasser did not really want that to happen. He was expecting Utant, next Secretary General of the UN, to resist and insist they remain in place. Nasser was acting out sort of a hold-me-back routine because he really did not want to go to war. What brought on his bravado was the behavior of the regime in Damascus and its protege terror cult at the time, Fatah. Since the Sinai campaign of 1956, when Israel gave Egypt a shellacking, the border with Gaza and Egypt had been blissfully quiet, and that drove the Syrians, who had contended with Egypt over who rules the land between them, since maybe the days of Hammurabi, to taunt Egypt, acknowledged leader of the Arab world. In 1959, Nasser had come up with the idea of rebranding the mixed bag of Arab refugees still in refugee slums as the Palestinian Entity, in Arabic, Al-Kiyan al-Falastini. Significantly, even he did not yet call them a nation. Still, as the major Arab backers of the FLN rebels in Algeria, the Egyptians saw the success of that propaganda effort in the Maghreb, which was continuing to speak the language of Islam among its people, but by referring to its killers as Mujahideen, holy warriors, but in French, they spoke the language of national liberation and freedom fighters. In reaction, eight Muslim brothers with ties to the refugees came together in Kuwait a few months later, also impressed by Algeria's terrorists who wanted to imitate the success of the FLN and to become killers too. All had been Muslim brothers. Indeed, one of the eight's father had implanted the Brotherhood in Mandatory Palestine after removing his family from Cairo on the orders of the Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna, who was a school teacher in Port Said. This man's name was Abdul Ra'uf al-Kidwa, and with him was a 10-year-old son named Rahman, later known to the world as Yasir Arafat. Arafat and the seven others had all been Muslim brothers, and they were determined to destroy Israel for that alone. Arafat as a boy, he later would claim, had also met Haji Amin al-Husseini, a distant relative on his mother's side, whom they all revered. They all knew his biography as Grand Mufti in Jerusalem, who furiously denied there was such a country as Palestine, and that he had been a paid servant of Adolf Hitler during the war. Indeed, in the early days of Fatah, their killers carried around pictures of Hitler in their pants pockets, given them by Arafat. In 1948 and again in 1956, Egypt had been beaten, and the idea of a Palestinian entity in 1959 was a reaction to these insults from Syria. In 1962, the FLN drove the French from Algeria, finally, and Algeria became an independent country. And that led in 1964 to the creation by Nasser in Jerusalem of the Palestine Liberation Organization, not to be confused with Fatah, in imitation of the FLN as well. But that, too, was a substitute for a serious confrontation with Israel. Nasser put Ahmed Shoukry in charge, a native of Lebanon, whose mother tongue was Turkish, at the head of this Palestine Liberation Organization. But all Shoukry ever did was run his mouth. He never organized any terror against Israel because Nasser did not want him to do that. In response, Fatah, sheltering under rival Syria's wing, was allowed to plot murder and mayhem in Israel, and its first operation was on January 1, 1965. And one of its purposes was to embarrass Nasser and other Arab states. And the first Fatah operation was placing a bomb on an installation of Israel's new national water carrier, built to irrigate the south by a series of pipes coming down from the Sea of Galilee. All the Arab states had protested the project, but did nothing to stop it. The Fatah bombing was meant to call them all a bunch of wimps. And then Fatah grew and started launching more attacks across Israel's ceasefire lines with the conscious intent of shaming the Arab governments into returning to war against Israel. And with Syria continuing to mock Egypt for being a paper tiger, Nasser huffed and puffed of his desire to wipe Israel off the map and, as noted, wound up ordering the UN units to depart forthwith, while not expecting that to happen. But when Utant amazingly and meekly complied, Nasser was forced to play out his threats and move his armored columns right up to the border. And when that happened, Israel felt the threat of annihilation as it had not since 1948, with the outcome uncertain. And when that happened, yours truly knew the terrain of action all too well. In the summer of 1965, I had worked on a kibbutz bordering the strip. And on Shabbosim, we would walk over to the ceasefire line to chat and drink Danish beer with the Scandinavian soldiers posted on the other side of fence, which was easy to pass through, nothing like today's Jurassic Park barrier. So when the media at that time reported on Egyptian armor driving up to that fence and aiming its cannon into the Jewish cottages of the communal farmers on the Israeli side, I knew the names of these people. They had become friends in those cottages. And I thought, holy you-know-what, I said to myself. For 2 weeks, the Arabs in their capitals of Cairo, Amman, Damascus, Baghdad held rallies. We saw them on the news. Millions of men, no women, of course, howling for a massacre of everybody in Israel. Itbach al Yahud in Arabic, slaughter the Jews. They wanted to finish Hitler's work. In Tel Aviv, volunteers answering civil defense authority requests for men began digging graves in public parks for the thousands expected to die. Foreign Minister Abba Eben raced from one Western capital to another begging for support. He called on the U.S. to remember its promise of 1956, given when Israel withdrew from the Sinai, to support Israel in such an eventuality, and of course was turned down. So much for ironclad international agreements. For 2 weeks, the world was waiting for Holocaust II, the sequel. And then the war began on Monday, June 5. Yours truly had just finished finals on that Friday at Columbia and expected to sleep late that Monday now that summer break had begun, but for some reason I awoke at 6 a.m. sharp and did something I never did in that period. Reached out for the radio, turned on the news, and there it was. War has broken out in the Middle East, fighting on all fronts. I jumped out of bed, got dressed, sped to the Israeli consulate in Manhattan to volunteer, but since I wasn't a citizen, the place for me, they said, was the Jewish agency. I went over there, they took my particulars, told me that maybe there would be a plane for volunteers that night. I was to go home and wait for a phone call. Instead, President Lyndon B. Johnson came on the air to declare the war zone off limits to American citizens. All I could do then was wait like everybody else, glued to the radio and the TV, everybody else concerned for Israel's fate. It was nerve-wracking. So, on the first day of the Six-Day War, and on the second day, the Israeli government said nothing. While the Arab governments did not stop announcing great victories. The oil refineries in Haifa had been destroyed, they said. Syrian officers were already sitting in the cafes of Tel Aviv. Presumably like Wehrmacht Offizieren sitting in the cafes in Paris in 1940, ordering the French around. It was a miserable 48 hours of a cloud of unknowing. But then on Wednesday, the Israelis started to raise the curtain on what had happened, which left the world stunned. Not only had there been no second Holocaust, the IDF had smashed the military establishments of four Arab states and was now 400% larger. And not only that, that day, the IDF had driven the Jordanians from Jerusalem, and the dividing wall was already being taken down by Israeli citizens. I'll never forget my mother that day, who was out shopping that morning, coming back just as this news came over the radio. My mother was a member of the Young Socialist League or something, for it was her mother and father at the turn of the 20th century who made the break from classical Jewishness. As the Christians over the last two centuries had lost their faith, so would many Jews, and too many also imbibed the dreams of a socialist world free of the opiate of the masses, in Karl Marx's terms. I am in possession of my grandfather's copy of Das Kapital in Yiddish. I also have his Engels and Bakunin in Yiddish. Darwin's Origin of Species. So my mother was raised to make jokes about religion. Not that she or my grandparents were hostile to Jews, just the opposite. Only for them, religion had nothing to do with it. So, in she walks, and as she puts her grocery bags on the kitchen counter, I tell her the news that Israel has not only survived, but Jerusalem has been liberated. Astonished, she held a breath and began to weep. This is the power of Jerusalem for the Jewish people for thousands of years. Has there ever been such a people that lost its country to another nation who, though defeated and scattered all over the world, never forgot its home country and its capital city, and indeed remembered it in prayers time and time again every day? Kosher laws require that when you eat bread, you not only make a blessing before you eat it, you say grace afterwards in four short blessings, one of them for Jerusalem. You drink a glass of wine, and the grace afterwards also mentions Jerusalem. You get married, and as part of the ritual, the groom stomps on a glass to shatter it, the message being you are now a couple, and may you have great joy and blessings, but never forget Jerusalem, which was smashed like that glass, and so on and so forth. And here we were in 1967 for the first time since the year 63 BCE, when Rome entered the country. Alone, we were the sovereign power in Jerusalem. A person can get dizzy from the contemplation of thousands of years of history. Once, browsing through Edward Gibbon's classic Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, I came upon a list of the peoples overrun by Rome, and most of them I'd never heard of. Even the ones we remember are gone. Celts, Etruscans, Druids, Visigoths, Vikings. That list contained names far more obscure. Jerusalem, by contrast, appears over 640 times in our Bible. In the Christian editions, it's 145 times. In the Quran, never. But don't tell today's post-Christian Europeans who think it should be the capital of the putatively Paleolithic Palestinians. And that the Jews don't want to share it with them, well, the Europeans are fixing to deal with that. Makor Rishon reported on Friday that now that a new government has been installed in Jerusalem, we can expect a visit from the famous Middle East expert and former communist youth group enthusiast Federica Mogherini to dictate to Israel that it must persuade her of its sincere desire to hand over Judea and Samaria, and of course the holy heart of Jerusalem, to the victims of Zionism, the ancient Palestinians, who have as much right to Jerusalem as the Jews, she thinks. Michael Rishon also reported that the EU is scratching its heads over how to punish the Jews for remaining in occupation of the Palestinian territories. They're thinking of depriving any Jew who has citizenship in an EU country of his citizenship if he lives in Judea and Samaria, which the Europeans call the occupied Palestinian territories, or denying visas to those who live in these territories and want to visit an EU country. Which reminds me, after the webcast, check out the link posted with this webcast. It's a hoot. I have a Facebook page for my book, and some Arab fellow came across it, and to combat calling his ancient people a phantom nation, an invented nation, he embedded a video which is on the City of Ramallah's official website. It's a black and white newsreel clip from the year 1939 of a soccer match in Sydney, Australia. And at the top, it's Palestine versus Australia. And the purpose of this embed was to prove that Palestine existed even before the State of Israel. And then there are the posts, comments in Arabic following. Facebook has a translation button, but most of the translations are unintelligible. Nonetheless, one senses the joy the posting is for these people to see these great Palestinian athletes in 1939 valiantly representing their ancient people. Only old-timers in Israel who see this clip recognize immediately one of the famous footballers of that period in Mandatory Palestine. For the Palestine team on the field was Maccabi Tel Aviv of that year. These are not Palestinians, as the City of Ramallah thinks, but Jews, Zionists. For 1939, only Jews called themselves Palestinians. No Arab would be caught dead calling himself a Palestinian in that year, not when their leader, Haji Amin al-Husseini, published a newspaper called Southern Syria, specifically to combat the invention of a territory called Palestine by the League of Nations, whose mandate explicitly called for creating Palestine as a Jewish homeland. It's rare for yours truly to hate the Arabs, and that's because they're so pathetic in their ignorance of just about everything, and especially the truth of history.
Yeah.
You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. Yes, I rarely hate the Arabs, even today, when one of them has murdered yet another Jew. 68-year-old watchman at a construction site in Estziona, where they're building or renovating a wedding hall, you know, where Jewish couples celebrate after smashing the glass. It seems a 26-year-old Ishmaelite came up to him and stabbed him in the neck. And he died before the medics could get him to hospital. Maybe you've noticed that style of Jew killing has been, as they say these days, trending lately. I think it comes from Muslim holidays where every man gets to slit the throat of a sheep and teach Junior the technique. In Jerusalem today, there were celebrations and, of course, rocks thrown at them at the celebrants by the sons of Ishmael near Damascus Gate. In my book, I reference the great Jewish philanthropist Moses Montefiore. In around the year 1868, I think, a century before the invasion of the Palestinians, petitioning the Sultan of Constantinople at the time to allow him to build an awning on the Temple Mount overhanging the Western Wall in order to shield Jews praying down below from Arab boys who had fun throwing rocks down on their praying heads. And the rock throwing today may have been encouraged by the meeting yesterday in the Vatican between the current Pope and the anti-Semitic terrorist and Holocaust denier Mahmoud Abbas. First report said the Pope called this demon an angel of peace. Later, this was amended to say that the Pope gave him some gift depicting an angel of peace and expressing the wish that Abbas would become one himself. Either way, this story stinks to high heaven. Even the second version is repulsive, for it shows the blind stupidity of this pontiff who thinks that Abbas, now 80 years old, after a life of slaughtering people, can become an angel of peace. This pope is himself 78 years old, meaning he was raised in a church that taught him all Jews were Christ killers, a doctrine not annulled until he was 28 years old. I remember Christmas Eve, 1975, and driving with friends into Bethlehem to watch the ceremonials of Midnight Mass and the faces of priests in Manger Square as they filed into the Church of the Nativity, who surely were not happy to be defended on all sides of the square and from the rooftops by snipers, IDF soldiers in combat gear, protecting them from wild Arabs, possibly thirsty for their infidel blood and to make a name for themselves. One wonders if this pope knows that inside the golden dome of the rock, for decoration, there are verses all around cursing Christianity. And I imagine these priests, bishops, and cardinals in 1975 were not too happy to find themselves protected by the army of the Jews on that night. It wasn't supposed to be that way.
שבויה בחלומה העיר אשר בדד יושבת ובליבה חומה ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא לכל שירייך אני כינו ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא לכל שירייך אני כינו ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא לכל שירייך אני כינו ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא
Last item on Thursday, Sultan Barack Hussein hosted a handful of mostly junior players representing the Gulf states at Camp David. Only two of the six country leaders of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, showed up because most of them have given up on Obama, who see him as Iran's man, the Iran they are deathly afraid of. Especially noticeable was the absence of the new Saudi King Salman. Sent instead was the Saudi interior minister and a deputy crown prince, and they even refused to appear at Camp David on Thursday, eating Obama in the Oval Office the day before. The New York Times last week quoted an anonymous Western diplomat in the Middle East who said, quote, "Of course the king's absence was a snub, but I don't think Obama is going to do this," meaning be deterred by this boycott of this meeting. Quote, "He wants the nuclear deal. It's the number one priority," close quote. Indeed it is. Obama, some say, is the son of a Shiite Muslim, and that's why he supports Iran against the Arabs, but I have my serious doubts. I go with the 14th century Christian philosopher William of Ockham, whose principle, now called Ockham's Razor, states that the simplest explanation is probably the right one. So I do not think Obama knows enough or cares enough about the Sunni-Shia divide to let it shape his course. He backs Iran because of all the Muslim countries in the Middle East, Iran is the one capable of dethroning Israel as the perceived military power. As he elbowed, so to speak, the Jews in America's side in favor of the Muslims in his inaugural speech, show Israel's prowess is an insult to believers, and Israel must be taken down. Israel must cease being the only atomic power in the region. How humiliating for believers. And above all, a nuclear Iran will have the ability to destroy Israel, God forbid, in a flash, or just threaten to attack and watch the tourists stay away and foreign investors stay away and watch Israel wither and die, God forbid. Barack Hussein Obama. Yimach Shimo, may his name be erased. So, Laila Tov, Meretz Yisrael, and don't forget to check out that posted link and have a giggle.